I will call this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is March 21st, 2024. A quorum is present. The first item on the agenda are the minutes. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 19th, 2024? So Representative Niska, thank you. Representative Niska moves approval of the minutes for March 19th, 2024. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Minutes are approved. We have a full agenda today to begin. All the testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit for testimony. Please adhere to those limits, or you may be cut off. Don't want to do that. Please adhere to those. Similarly, members of the public who choose to testify will be provided with a time limit. The time limits are provided so that we can keep the meeting on time and hear from as many people as possible. First item on the agenda, Chairbreaker Finn, would you like to move to recommend that House File 3872 be placed on the General Register?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is my motion, and then I would also move the DE3 amendment before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Please go ahead and speak to the DE3 amendment.
Yeah, so there's a couple things we're adding, so I will then move the A3 amendment to the DE3. The A3 contains two sections from House File 3506, which was the Representative Stevenson collateral source bill, so not adding the entirety of that bill, but just a couple sections from it. So that would be the A3 to the DE3.
Madam Chair has moved the A3 amendment. The A3 amendment is before us. Members, any discussion to the A3 amendment? Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Becker Finn. I just was hoping you could explain what is the legal effect. I guess there, we have two sections now that we've taken from that bill that we previously heard, and I was just hoping you could explain what I guess I'm mostly interested in section two now, I think, which I think was section four from before, the reallocation piece, changing the word A from any, or A to any. What change is that going to have practically in collection of a judgment?
Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as you noted, we're changing the word A to removing A and adding any, so instead of just one person, it would apply to any party.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Becker Finn, that seems fairly minor to me. Is that, what is the problem that's created by having the word A there instead of any?
Chair Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know that I'd say it's a problem. It's just this was what Representative Stevenson had been working with the parties to try to find the things that were least objectionable to folks, and this was a change that folks were willing to agree on.
Representative Niska.
That's all I have. Thanks.
Seeing no further discussion to the A3 amendment, Chair Becker Finn renews her motion to adopt the A3 amendment to the DE3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Feist, would you like to move the A2 amendment to the DE3?
Yes, so moved.
We have the A2 amendment to the DE3 amendment in front of us. Representative Feist, would you like to speak to the amendment?
Yes, thank you. So this is the guardianship immunity language that we heard before this committee, addressing a 2022 Court of Appeals case that surprised everyone in saying that guardians have absolutely no civil liability whatsoever, no matter how egregious their behavior. So this reflects some amendments to the language based on conversations with stakeholders, as well as some language to permit guardians to resign if there is no successor guardian in limited circumstances, also based on conversations with stakeholders.
Any further discussion? Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Feist, thank you for the work that you did with stakeholders on this. I think this does get a lot more towards a sort of narrow fix of that particular problem raised there without potentially creating other damage other places. So I do really appreciate that. I did want to just note that this issue and the way that this bill came up before us, I think, is a really, really important reminder to us about how difficult our process can be for other people out in the world who maybe are very, trained and focused on and interested in a particular issue, but they might not even really fully understand the changes that we're making. It was eye-opening to me that there were so many people who were interested and had a strong view about what we were doing, who I hadn't heard of before they, you know, happened to come to the hearing and try to speak up. And so it's good that they were able to catch it, at least at that point. But I think we should be we should be pretty humble in this process about there are lots of people out there in the state of Minnesota who might know things about a particular area that we're working in and might not even know that they should be coming to us to share their perspective. So, but I really do appreciate Representative Feist, the work that you've done on this to really, you know, focus in on what I think we all agree is a problem that should be corrected. So thank you.
Chair Breckenfein.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and just wanted to comment, you know, I teach legislative process, and part of that is sort of making sure that folks who are not paid lobbyists understand how this place works. So I appreciate the comment and would encourage others to give weight to the general public just as much as folks listen to the folks who are paid to be here. So totally agree with you that we could all do better on that.
Thank you, Chair.
And would support the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Chair Breckenfein. Thank you, Representative Niska. Yes, there are a lot of smart people out there in the public. They don't just reside here. Any further discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing no further discussion to the A2 amendment, Representative Feist renews her motion to adopt the A2 amendment to the DE3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Madam Chair, now to the presentation of the DE3 as amended.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is our policy omnibus bill for the year. So thank you for making all those motions, Mr. Vice Chair, getting in the bill the shape that we would like. I do want to thank staff. It's been, for folks who are not aware, one of our researchers is away on National Guard duty, and this last couple weeks has been especially challenging for our staff being down on members. So I just want to give a shout out to all of you. And to that, one of our researchers is out sick today. So she was going to do the walkthrough, but I can handle it. But just wanted to note that because it has been especially difficult in the public safety judiciary space to be down down a team member this year. So the DE3, I'll just go through real quick, and then I know there's a couple other amendments. So it contains House File 4326, which was the Representative Curran bill on judicial and court safety. It also has House File 3830, which was the Representative Holland's bill that we moved earlier this week, just clarifying the anti-nuptial agreements, changing the language to any two people instead of having the language gendered. 3872, the underlying bill, that was the judicial branch finance and policy bill. We took the policy provisions, and they're still in this bill. There were a couple of sections, Section 7 and 9, that we discussed relevant to service of OFPs, and those are actually being carried in the public safety omnibus bill. So didn't want folks to think we didn't think that was important. It's just public safety is carrying those provisions. Then, as we noted, we added some language from House Bill 3483, which was the Representative Feist bill on guardianship. Also includes the policy-only provisions from the Board of Public Defense bill, House Bill 3607, Representative Finke's bill, and Representative Curran's House File 4276, which was the language we passed earlier this week, changing the terms husband and wife just to spouse. And then finally, we added those couple of provisions from the Representative Stevenson collateral source bill. So not the biggest policy omnibus, but important nonetheless, and happy to go to public testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have Sarah Strong on the list. Please come on down. Please introduce yourself, share your pronouns if you like, and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Sarah Strong. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Newspaper Association, which represents 260 newspapers across the state, to express opposition to Sections 5 and 9 of Article 3. These sections would eliminate the longstanding requirement that important notifications issued by the judicial branch be published in newspapers. Instead, those notices would be posted on a judicial branch website. When M&A met with judicial representatives, they cited a few reasons for the proposal. First, that these notices should be available online, which they currently are. State law already requires that notices published in newspapers must also be posted on the newspaper's website, in front of any paywall, and on the statewide public notice website at no additional cost to the advertiser. Second, that these notices should be searchable, and they currently are. MNPublicNotice.com, the statewide public notice website, is searchable and contains all required public notices for the entire state. Third, that placing newspaper notices is an administrative burden. M&A assists other state agencies and public entities to place public notices efficiently and welcomes the opportunity to continue talking with the judicial branch about how they can assist them in making the publication process more efficient. When published in local newspapers and posted on their websites, those notices will be widely seen. 86% of Minnesota adults read their local print or digital newspapers each month. We are confident that public notices in newspapers and on their websites are more likely to be seen by the parties who are subjects of the notice or by others who know those parties than those posted only on the judicial branch website. Public notices placed in newspapers as a means of alternative service of process of legal documents has been validated by decades of experience and practice. Making this kind of dramatic change could raise questions about the legitimacy of service and invite due process challenges. The cost of publishing these notices has been reported to be roughly $240,000. Informing affected individuals and the public about important legal proceedings is an appropriate use of such a modest amount of the judicial branch's budget. The Newspaper Association respectfully requests the committee remove these sections. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Strong. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on the DE3 as amended before we move to the other pre-filed amendments? Seeing no other members of the public, Representative Scott, would you like to move the A4 amendment to the DE3 amendment?
Vice Chair Frazier, yes, I would.
Representative Scott, go ahead and speak to the amendment.
This just narrows the protections for the judiciary branch and what their ask is in Article 1. I just feel it's so broad and that other agencies, other units of government are going to come, and this is going to be precedent setting. They're going to come and they're going to want the same protections. And I think also from a practical standpoint, it's going to be really difficult for local units of government and other entities to keep up with who's an employee of the judiciary and who's not, and who's protected and who's not. And I just feel like that really, for transparency purposes and for practical purposes, I felt that that language was too broad, and so I would ask for your support on the A4. Thank you.
Chair Rebecca Finn.
Thank you, Vice Chair. So interestingly, the lead in the public safety had the opposite opinion of you. I believe lead Novotny said, "What makes you so special?" was the quote. So we actually think that keeping the language as it is actually the middle ground between your position and lead Novotny's position. Lead Novotny actually wanted to expand it to even more people. I wasn't so sure about that. And so keeping the language as it is actually the middle ground between the two arguments to just keep it to judicial judicial folks. So I would oppose the A4 amendment.
Thank you. Any further discussion, members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frazier. Well, that's the great thing about this place is even people within their own party can disagree on things. And I just would ask for member support. This is precedent setting. It's far too broad. And I would ask for member support. Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Scott renews her motion to adopt the A4 amendment to the DE3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. The motion is not adopted. Member discussion on the DE3 as amended. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. And this is for the author. you and I have a common experience in Hennepin County Family Court. So as you know, there's judges, there's there's referees, and then there's magistrates. So looking at personal information in section 2 regarding the definition of judicial official, it seems that it covers obviously judges and then referees, but I was wondering about magistrates. As I recall, in Hennepin, they're under contract, so they're not technically employees. They're probably 1099 folks. So do you intend to cover magistrates in this as well? And I'm looking at
Representative Kerr, can you pull your mic a little closer?
Sure.
Thank you.
Looking at section 2 in regarding in line 2.2, employees of the judicial branch. Can you comment on that, please?
Chair Beckerfan.
Thank you, Vice Chair. The intention is to cover all judicial officials. If there are unique hiring practices in individual counties out of all 87 counties, I'm not really privy to that. If you would like to bring an amendment to make that more clear, you are more than welcome to do so.
Thank you. Thank you.
Are you done? Representative Carroll?
That's fine. Thank you.
All right. Any other member discussion? Johnson.
Vice Chair Howard, Chair Beckerfin, Fraser, I'm sorry.
That's all right. It's early then.
It's way too early.
They look so similar.
Wish I had that hair.
I do have concerns about the public notice issue. Even in my area, 50 miles north of here, we have areas that the only type of internet they have is dial-up. We don't have broadband. We don't have DSL. They have to call in on their phone to hook up their computer with dial-up. Now, these public notices in the papers are important because there's a lot of times that's the only way that these people are going to find out that information. What these public notices are. Is it down the road a possibility to change that? Yes, but we're not there yet. We have a lot of areas of the state that do not have access to the internet. We have a lot of kids yet that to do their homework, they have to go to the library, they have to go outside McDonald's to hook up to the internet to do their homework. So I think this is a little premature right now, and I think we need to really look at that and possibly fix that, because it right now, without that paper, it's the only way a lot of people are going to get these court notices and these court notifications.
Chair McAfee.
Thank you, Vice Chair. And I will note for the record, I know there are probably some members of the legislature who don't remember dial-up internet, but I did live in rural Minnesota when dial-up internet was a thing, so I'm well aware of the technology. I think we've had this conversation on and off throughout the years as technology has changed, and I think we're just at the point where technology is at a point where it makes sense for us to make this change. I understand that there are some business interests, and that it is challenging to own a newspaper publishing company in 2024, but I think that's just the nature of the change of technology. So I hear you. I also have students in my district who don't have internet at home, but as you noted, there's lots of public places where it is available.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Johnson? All right. Seeing no further discussion, Chair Beckerfan renews her motion to adopt the DE3 amendment as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Now to House File 3872 as amended. Chair Beckerfan renews her motion to recommend that House File 3872 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. On your way.
Thanks for your patience, members, as we do the musical chairs. Waiting on an author. It's Big Badgie. For those at home that are like, why aren't they doing anything? It's the time of year where there are multiple important things happening in multiple committees, and we're trying to get people shuffled around to the right room so they can present their bills. So we're going to go a little bit out of order. I will move to recommend that House Bill 3591 be placed on the general register. This is a representative. Oh, actually, Representative Howard. All right, yes. Chair Howard, we now have Representative Ryer here, so I will rescind my motion.
And I will gladly.
But for the record, that is Representative Howard.
My brother.
Yeah.
Yes. Good morning. You were also speedy. Sorry.
Yep. No, that's how we roll in judiciary. I will move the House Bill 4100. Representative Ryer's bill. We're moving the House Bill 4100 be referred to the Tax Committee. Representative Ryer, welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. I'm here today to talk about House File 4100, the Minnesota Debt Fairness Act. The current version of this bill is the product of many hours, many meetings, and a great deal of valuable input from stakeholders across the board. My thanks to all who have been involved. I'd like to ground the conversation in the reasons for this bill. Minnesotans are under a great deal of financial pressure from debt, and we've seen in multiple studies that medical debt, consumer debt, and financial distress are strongly intertwined. People with medical debt are more apt to have no rainy day fund, to be overdrawn, have credit card debt, or file for bankruptcy. 59% of people with medical debt have skipped care due to cost, and those with medical debt have more days of poor physical and mental health, more years of life lost, and higher mortality rates for both all cause and leading causes of death. This is an equity issue, and one study author noted that our findings reinforce medical debt as a social determinant of health. I'm carrying this bill because people need to be able to afford their lives and to not have their health impaired. At the same time, businesses need to be able to depend on people paying their bills. The provisions of this bill help accomplish these goals. In the garnishment area, we modernize language and adjust details about the property people can keep when going through bankruptcy, and we're working on ways to help preserve a limited amount of solvency when being garnished. For medical debt, the bill focuses on preserving access to care, protecting consumers from unfair liability for medical debt, and providing additional consumer protections to people with medical debt. We also remove revenue recapture as a collection option. The work continues, and I'm encouraged by the open dialogue and creative problem solving among all concerned. My goal remains a fair debt collection system that keeps people out of poverty and keeps our businesses strong. I ask for your support to re-refer this bill to taxes to keep it moving as we continue our productive discussion to create the best possible bill. Thank you.
All right. We do have several public members of the public signed up to testify. First up, I have Jessica Whitney. And then on deck, I have Jay Singleton. And when I tell you that you're on deck, if you could move closer to the table so we can keep things moving, that would be appreciated. All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Becker Finn and members. I'm Jessica Whitney, Deputy Attorney General in the Consumer Protection Area. The Office of the Minnesota Attorney General appears here today to support House File 4100, the Minnesota Debt Fairness Act. It strikes that balance between helping between fairness and people paying back their debt and getting their debts paid back so they're not drifted into a cycle of poverty. The bill, as Representative Ryer notes, reflects long meetings with all stakeholders. Anyone that wants to join us, we're still meeting at 8 a.m. in the morning, and you're welcome to come. Representative Breyer asked me to do an overview of the bill, so I'm just going to go quickly through it, and I can answer questions later. Starting with the medical debt portions of the bill, it would allow patients to seek medically necessary care regardless of whether they have outstanding medical debt. It would also join numerous other states in prohibiting the reporting of medical debt for credit reporting agencies. It would further eliminate the Minnesota penalty against married people, which makes them automatically liable for their spouse's debt and makes Minnesota an outlier in this case. And it's like no other debt. We have made medical debt, you're responsible for your spouse's debt. Additionally, the current language of the bill would eliminate, as Representative Breyer notes, revenue recapture and require medical providers to make their collection practices available to the public and would enhance the ability for patients to challenge medical bills that they believe were wrongly coded by their provider or insurance. It also creates a basic consumer right for patients with medical debt. For example, it allows patients who successfully defend against a wrongful lawsuit for medical debt to request payment of their costs and fees. It also includes protections against using false and misleading statements to collect medical debt or using threats of illegal activity to compel payment of medical debt. Both the patients themselves and the Attorney General would have the ability to enforce these rights, with patients having the ability to seek damages as well as costs and fees. And just to be clear, the medical debt provisions apply only to debt directed to providers, and a patient who puts a medical expense on a credit card would have their debt treated like any other credit card debt. Third, the bill creates a basic protection for levy from a baseline amount of money in a person's bank account to prevent perfectly legal judgment collection from interfering with someone's ability to pay for their very basic rights like rent for their home, groceries. In doing this, Minnesota would join North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and many other states who have this baseline protection. Incidentally, this protection was the primary recommendation to come from a report on consumer debt collection published by the Minnesota State Bar Association a few months ago. The bill currently proposes protecting an aggregate of $4,000 across all of someone's bank accounts, so they can't have many bank accounts at once. This is a reduction from the $5,000 that was originally in the bill and where Wisconsin stands, and we're still talking about this provision and needing to further refine it. The bill also creates new garnishment levels based on income, and this was a great idea that was proposed by the Minnesota creditors advocates. Our current law allows everyone with an income level below $22,000 a year to be exempt from garnishment, and anyone above that level is then automatically subject to a 25% garnishment of their wage account. And you can imagine if you're earning $25,000 a year, 25% of that paycheck is a whole lot, and you're going to be struggling to pay rent or for food. So we've got now a graduated system that would start at 5% and adjust in different levels and go up to the 25% level once you hit a certain threshold. So this proposal would really help the working poor, the working class, and lower middle income people live with wage garnishment and help creditors get their money and debtors pay back their bills. And finally, the bill would also apply Minnesota's garnishment laws to independent contractors and self-employed people, and would apply Minnesota garnishment law to all people who live and work in Minnesota, regardless of what state the collector is located in, and that has been an issue. And then, as Representative Breyer noted, we have some modernization of some of the bankruptcy provisions that are occurring. The Debt Fairness Act seeks to make compulsory payment of medical debt and regular debt process more fair to everyone so that at these challenging times, and the finance people can operate within the system. To that end, the Attorney General's Office supports the passage of House File 4100. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Jay Singleton. And then on deck, I have Ron Elwood. And if you could introduce yourself for the record, share your pronouns if you'd like, and then proceed.
Thank you. My name is Jay Singleton, she, her pronouns, and I'm the Program Manager at Legal Services State Support. Today, I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota State Bar Association's Access to Justice Committee to speak in, specifically in support of Section 28 of the Minnesota Debt Fairness Act. The Access to Justice Committee is dedicated to advancing solutions that help all people, particularly those with lower incomes or who have limited access to legal assistance, to obtain the legal help and resources that they need to receive equal access to justice. In October 2023, as mentioned previously, the committee released a report on consumer debt litigation in Minnesota. This report came about because consumer debt litigation has historically had one of the biggest gaps in representation. Consumers almost never have representation, while creditors almost always do. The report analyzed nearly 700,000 Minnesota consumer debt cases over 10 years. We also looked at how Minnesota's policies compare to those of other states and spoke to stakeholders to see what is happening day to day in those cases, including with legal aid lawyers, creditor attorneys, the AG's consumer team, members of the judicial branch, and consumers themselves. What we found was eye-opening. Over half of all civil cases in Minnesota are consumer debt cases, by which we mean cases where a business or organization is suing someone for an individual debt. Due to complexity, confusion, and those low representation rates, Minnesotans largely do not participate in their cases. The result is that their wages are garnished and their personal bank accounts end up drained. We also found that Black and Latino Minnesotans are being sued at higher rates than their white counterparts, even when controlling for income. And finally, our report mapped debt rates around the state and found that this is not just a metro area issue. The counties with the highest rates of consumer debt cases are in Greater Minnesota. One of the four recommendations from the report was to preserve economic stability so Minnesotans can afford basic needs while repaying their debts. Section 28 of the proposed legislation does this by protecting Minnesotans' bank accounts so that creditors can't clear out consumers' bank accounts, leaving them vulnerable to hunger, eviction, job loss, and falling even further behind on their debts. For these reasons, the Access to Justice Committee strongly supports Section 28 of the Minnesota Debt Fairness Act.
Thank you for your testimony. I have Ron Elwood, and then I have Ronald Lundquist on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Nice to be back in front of you again. I'd like to echo Representative Breyer's request to pass this bill through this committee and allow us to keep working with the parties. I just want to highlight a few points. Some of them have been made, but I just want to emphasize how important some of these provisions are. You know, while we do have a garnishment process in Minnesota that over the years we've worked with our colleagues in the creditor and collections arena to improve, this process, frankly, is still extremely confusing for consumers and difficult to navigate. And as a result, folks struggle to maintain enough money to meet their basic needs while being able to repay their debts. So the bank account protection that has been mentioned a couple of times, I just can't emphasize enough how important that is to enact in some form. Because think about this, you get garnished, your bank account is frozen. And even if you have exemptions, and even if you have right to some or all of that money, that account is just frozen for a while. And as it's frozen, the cascade of horribles proceed. You can't pay your rent. You can't buy food. You can't meet basic needs, but pay your health care. So if we could find a way to work something out that we can protect a bank account from a certain amount in a bank account from garnishment so people can pay their rent, pay their mortgage, and buy food, it would be incredibly great. And the second thing I'd like to highlight again is the protection of the independent contractor, the sole proprietor, the small business owner who works for themselves. Because Minnesota, if you earn wages, if you have an employer, you have all these protections under the current law and hopefully improved protections that will occur when this bill is passed. If you work for yourself, if you're an independent contractor, you have none of those protections. Your money is completely wiped out. So with that, I'd just like to say thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I urge you to pass this bill and let us keep working with the stakeholders to get a fair debt process in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Ronald Lundquist and then Dana Bacon. Please introduce yourself for the record and share your pronouns if you like.
Yes, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you so much for taking my testimony today. My name is Ron Lundquist. I'm an attorney in Eagan, Minnesota. I'm a former member of the Rules Committee and the Practice Committee for the Bankruptcy Court here in Minnesota. And although I don't speak for VLN, I'm on the Board of Directors for the Volunteer Lawyer Network. My practice is focused on helping clients who, because of illness or disability or unemployment or underemployment or some other calamity, find their backs up against the wall and file for bankruptcy relief against aggressive creditors. I do want the committee to know that people file bankruptcy typically as their last resort. They're not evading responsibility for debt. Their backs up are against the wall, and they're usually threatened by creditors with, you know, garnishment or bank levy, repossession, foreclosure, things of that nature. It's critical to modernize Minnesota's debtor-creditor law, including our exemption laws, which this bill does. Exemptions protect basic property from creditor seizure. For example, our current laws are woefully outdated and should be modernized. For example, Minnesota law currently protects a phonograph from creditor seizure, but it won't protect a computer. Minnesota law will currently protect a Bible or a church pew from seizure, but it won't protect a Quran or a prayer rug. Current Minnesota law protects a claim for personal and physical injury, but it won't protect the settlement from the same injury. Current Minnesota law will not protect a claim or settlement for harms that we now realize are real and serious, such as claims for sexual harassment or emotional abuse. So please pass this legislation. Give life to the spirit of the Minnesota State Constitution, which states at Article 1, Section 12, that, quote, a reasonable amount of property shall be exempt from seizure or sale for the payment of any debt or liability, unquote. It's within your power to greatly improve the lives of Minnesotans who are most powerless and who are most in need of your help. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Dana Bacon, and then I have Derek Weber on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dana Bacon. I'm from Rosemount, and I'm here today as Senior Director of State Government Affairs for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. I'm also here today to voice support for House File 4100. I mean, we know medical debt is one of the categories of consumer debt that can cause serious economic, emotional, and physical harm. I mean, we need better protections for patients and Minnesotans facing these challenges, and this legislation is going to help. I would like to call your attention to a letter that I hope you have in your packet, signed by my organization, the ALS Association, American Cancer Society, Cancer Action Network, the ARC of Minnesota, Cancer Legal Care, Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers, Minnesota Budget Project, Minnesota Nurses Association, National Kidney Foundation, and National Multiple Sclerosis Society. These are some of the many groups who are hoping that you will move this legislation forward today. I don't want to belabor the technical aspects of medical debt because this is the Judiciary Committee, but I would encourage members to remember that the pieces of this legislation that fall under your jurisdiction will have a beneficial impact on the lives of people facing medical debt in Minnesota. They're basically, you know, two sides of a coin. If you make these systems work better for people facing consumer debt, you're going to make these systems work better for people facing medical debt. So we hope you'll take this step forward. Our patients are looking for a fair shot, not a free pass. So with that, I'd like to thank Representative Ryer, the members of the committee who've already signed on as co-sponsors. There are four of you the last I looked, the governor's office, the attorney general's office, and please vote yes today. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Derek Weber, and then I have Jessica Klander on deck. Please introduce yourself, share your pronouns if you'd like, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Derek Weber. I'm an attorney with Messerling Kramer. I've been an attorney in Minnesota for over 30 years and the last 22 with Messerling Kramer. But over that time, I've represented consumers and creditors. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Creditors Rights Association. This is an organization of lawyers and law firms, 20 law firms and over 50 lawyers that represent creditors in legal proceedings to help recover unpaid debt or collateral. We have a long history of working with legal aid over the last 20 years and the Attorney General and senators and representatives to come up with changes and ideas, and as Representative Breyer has indicated to you, generated some really good ideas already. The problem is that we haven't had enough time, and while the proponents of this bill worked for 6-7 months behind closed doors over the summer to create this, we've had really only a couple weeks to digest it. In fact, some people are just finding out about it right now. Now, it sounds really bad in Minnesota, but I will tell you that's not the case. Minnesota's creditors or consumers are actually in really pretty good shape. We have the highest credit score in the country of all people. We have only a 3% default rate on consumer debt. That means that 97% of the people are paying their debt. The stories told are that we don't have enough protection. We actually have one of the most liberal protection packages of $675,000 worth of assets are protected. That's what a reasonable amount is. Now, we're not opposed to creating some updates and some things and some mandates, but these exemptions are too rich. And the bill adds significant assets and does not just modernize assets. The most concerning to our group is the automatic bank exemption. It's not laid out properly and clearly, and actually it's $4,000 in any and every bank account you can have. And so we want the time to work with the people to get the language right, to get the implementation right, and we will continue to work with the teams as we go through this. And I thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you for your testimony. I have Jessica Klander. And then are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, looks like you're our final testifier. Please introduce yourself, share your pronouns if you'd like, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Klander, and I'm an attorney at Bassford Remley. I'm here today on behalf of the Great Lakes Credit and Collections Association, or GLICA, to share our thoughts on the bill. First, I would like to thank Representative Ryer, the Attorney General's Office, and Legal Aid for engaging with us over the past few weeks to remove some of the most concerning aspects of this bill. And while we do have some concerns that remain, we are dedicated and committed to continuing this dialogue to reach some agreement. It's important that any changes made to the laws governing the collections process be done with a focus on balance. Our most significant concerns with the bill focus on the changes to the wage and bank garnishment process. While we recognize the need to protect consumers facing hardship, we need a process that allows those that can pay to do so. The proposal of a $4,000 bank account exemption will effectively take bank garnishment off the table as a tool for collections. Few people maintain that high of an account balance at any given time, and those that do can move their money between accounts to avoid their obligations. In many cases, despite numerous communications, a bank garnishment summons is the first time a consumer engages in the collections process. This allows an opportunity to work out a payment arrangement and negate the need for a garnishment at all. The self-executing exemption portion of this wage of the bank garnishment will mean that that will take that engagement off of the table. It doesn't require the consumer to actually take or trigger the exemption. It is self-executing, which prompts additional concerns about the loss of that engagement with the consumer. We would also caution against making one-to-one comparisons with other states. Yes, some states do have bank garnishment exemptions, but some are as low as a few hundred dollars, and processes for garnishments in those states are very different, and so as a whole don't look the same as here. GLICA is willing to continue discussing the possibility of a bank account exemption that's more balanced, both in the amount and the process, so bank garnishment remains an option for collections. We thank you so much.
All right, thank you for your testimony. With that, we will move on to member discussion. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Ryer, thank you for the work that you have done to improve this bill. We saw it in Commerce, and I appreciate the fact that there has been some dialogue on it. And there's some provisions in here that I think everybody could get behind. Obviously, modernizing the language of the exemptions, in particular, you know, one of the testifiers referenced the expansion of the sacred possessions exemption to make clear that it's inclusive of everybody of every faith. I think, you know, we can all get behind a lot of that stuff. I do think that there are a lot of concerns that were raised today that indicate there's a lot of work that still needs to be done on this. And so I'm hopeful that you will continue to do that work and get this bill into better shape. But that's my comment on the bill.
All right, Representative Johnson.
Chair Rebecca Finn, Representative Ryer. I do have concerns on this bill as well. Just yesterday, my credit unions happened to stop by for credit union day at the Capitol. And the only bill they talked about was this one. They have concerns. They're not sure how it's going to work. They're not sure if they're going to be held liable or if they happen to have an order and that they have to do something. And so they release the funds or freeze the funds. They don't know if they're going to be held liable. They don't know. There's concerns because this is moving so fast, and they haven't had a chance to process what's going on, because as the other testifier said, they've only had a couple weeks to digest this. One thing I want to note is before the ACA Act, Minnesota had probably the best health care. We probably still do in the country. We had the best access to health care in the country. We don't anymore. It's become unaffordable. Why? Because of the ACA Act, the programs we had to keep health insurance down were no longer legal. So what we ended up with is high insurance premiums and high deductibles. I know where it's just that a family having a $2,000 deductible is $2,000 per person, so that's $8,000 for a family of four, and that gets expensive. And the premiums are expensive, and the copays are expensive. So that drives up the cost, and at this point, Minnesota medical debt is only 2% of the entire debt. So we have very low debt, so people are paying their medical bills. I do ask that you keep working on this to make it better. As Representative Niska said, there's some things that we do need to update. But right now, I think this goes too far, and it could, in the long run, might cause some problems.
Thank you. I will note for the record, because it's been noted a couple times, that the bill was introduced in February. It's followed the normal process of hearing a bill in the legislature. This is the second committee stop. Everything's been publicly noticed, and I assume folks have the resources to advocate for their position. So, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and Representative Breyer, for your bill. I just wanted to point out a couple of pieces. The first, I appreciate your comments in the opening that this is an equity issue. Medical debt affects communities very unequally. We heard a couple of times about how high Minnesota ranks in certain social determinant factors. We also rank right at the top, sometimes number one in education, knowing that we also have the highest racial gaps in education in the country. When we say we are the best credit scores in the country, I tend to believe that that is for white people, because credit scores are a disastrous racist program that should be ended, in my opinion. And there's a long record of how that works. I also want to say that medical debt affects LGBTQ people, especially people with HIV, at very high rates. The nature of our health care is such that it is ongoing. And people with HIV, when these communities suffer from the problems of medical debt, not only does it interrupt their health care, increase their visits to the emergency room, but it also directly conflicts with our public policy goals of the eradication of new HIV transmissions. So this is serving multiple purposes for multiple communities. I'm really grateful that you brought it, and I appreciate your work.
Thank you. Any other committee discussion to the bill? All right. Closing comments, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. I want to thank everyone for the encouragement and the cautions and the guidance on continuing to work. It's been very important to everyone involved, and I'm going to put myself at the center on that we have something that does work, that improves people's financial well-being, improves their access to the goods and services that people need, and also looks out for businesses. As a longtime person who's worked in the business world, I am not indifferent to those concerns, yet I know that we have a long way to go. And I have great partners on all parts of the issue, so we'll keep it going. Thank you.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion to recommend that House File 4100 be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right. Now, Representative Howard.
Uh-huh.
I will move to recommend that House Bill 3591 be placed on the general register. I will note this is a Representative Egbaje bill, but we have Representative Howard pinch hitting for this bill for right now. I will then also move the DE4 amendment in front of us, and this is the landlord-tenant omnibus bill policy package. And then Representative Howard, I understand we have the A10 amendment, which is an author's amendment. So I will move the A10 amendment. Representative Howard, if you can tell us what that amendment does.
Chair Becker-Finn, members, I will admit, I was hoping that we'd see Representative Baje walk through the door. And if that happens at any point, we will definitely swap out. But the A10 makes a series of changes based on feedback from stakeholders. I think the most substantive piece is we have added the source of income discrimination piece to the landlord-tenant bill. That's a bill that's passed the House, I think every year I've been in the legislature, and we've added it to this DE amendment. And the balance of the other changes are based on feedback from stakeholders on the bill.
All right. Any discussion to the A10? Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was really hoping we could take the amendments in the order they were timestamped. The A5 and the A11, which I was hoping to offer, are both subsumed within the A10. So I don't know if I should. That means I should support the amendment, or if I should be mad that I'm not going to get back on a.
Following timestamps is not a thing, Representative Niska. But thanks for trying.
I appreciate that you've taken some of the good ideas I was hoping to offer. That's my comment.
All right, thank you. Any further discussion to the A10? All right, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Howard, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and members. This bill includes new policies related to landlord-tenant law, as well as clarifications to policies passed in last year's landlord-tenant package. The intent and purpose is to continue on with policies to further make clear the responsibilities of tenants and landlords in their residential relationship. Some of the policies in this package ensure that tenants can organize with their neighbors without fear of retaliation, call in emergency services in a mental health crisis without fear of eviction, and prohibit discrimination based on the source of income you will use to pay for your rent. Other parts of the bill work to clarify policies that have long been in place or were recently enacted. One example of this is ensuring that survivors of domestic violence can terminate their lease for safety reasons, and then if they follow all the procedures, a landlord cannot evict them. The bill also clarifies that mandatory expungements that are older than 3 years should fall off a person's record. This is clarifying the intent of legislation we passed last year. Additionally, the bill works to ensure that only the most up-to-date court records are shown on a screening record to help limit the number of pending cases shown up on a tenant screening report. This is to help people get back on their feet and be able to rent from better places, especially if they were never adjudicated to be evicted in the first place. In order for more people to know they have access to housing, the bill allows for an opportunity for a potential tenant to give an ITIN number when they do not have a Social Security number. Without this provision, potential tenants don't even bother to fill out rental applications for fear of reprisal because of their immigration status. I'll note on this one, we've had a lot of positive interaction with Minnesota Multi-Housing about how to craft this language in a way that will work, and we continue to have those conversations. This bill also seeks to make explicit what remedies and enforcement for current provisions in Chapter 504B should look like. It includes remedies for various sections that didn't have specific remedies identified previously. The remedies range from $250 to $1,000 and provide, while also allowing the court for other actual or consequential damages. In addition to these remedies, the bill proposes to expand habitability to common spaces to ensure that those areas are fit for use, particularly in and around entrances and hallways and buildings or complexes. The bill specifies remedies for when a unit isn't ready on time or when repairs have been left to languish. Should a new construction not be ready on time after a tenant has made deposits, provisions in this bill spell out the type of remedy that that a tenant would could receive. This is has been in the news about a particular housing project in Dinkytown that left students really in a terrible situation, and this bill seeks to address those concerns going forward. This bill also, in a situation where a tenant has waited for repairs, the bill lays out a more straightforward path for how a tenant can fix the repairs on their own by providing notice and hiring a licensed professional should the landlord continue to be unresponsive. The language and the authors in this amendment to the DE further updates our eviction processes to ensure that landlords understand their responsibilities in serving notice for an eviction and how to mail service if a tenant cannot be found. Additional clarifications in the bill include specifying that leases cannot be required to be renewed before there are 6 months left in the lease. This isn't a clarification based on legislation we looked at last year. Late fees on rent and subsidized housing is only applied to the tenant's portion of the rent. The right to counsel in public housing is only for project-based housing like Section 9 housing. And then if you are infirmed, you and others in your tenancy are able to terminate the lease based on that infirmity, which is, again, as a clarification on a bill that had bipartisan support last year. This package continues the path as we started last year to continue to update Minnesotans' landlord-tenant laws to bring them into the 21st century. And it's the cumulative effort of various housing advocacy groups and engagement with Minnesota Multi-Housing. I want to note the productive engagement of all stakeholders, and this bill reflects a lot of changes. We heard from advocacy groups, not only advocacy groups, but Minnesota Multi-Housing, and have really appreciated their engagement. We continue to be engaged in those conversations to finalize some last pieces of the bill as it continues to move through the legislative process. With that, I'll thank members and turn it over to testifiers.
Yep, and we do have a couple people signed up. I have Rachel Sterling, and then Juan Luis Rivera Reyes. If you want to come on up and get ready to testify, you'll be next. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hello. Good morning. Excuse me, Chair Beckerfin and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Sterling. I use she, her pronouns, and I am a housing attorney at Homeline. I'm here in support of House File 3591, and while there's lots of things to like in this bill, I'm going to focus my testimony on Article 5 of that DE4 amendment. So it's no secret that landlords write leases, and they understandably write them to so that they benefit from the terms. Makes sense. So the most effective tenants have very little power in negotiating what those terms are. So the most effective way to protect tenants and create any kind of balance between the parties is through statutes and ordinances, which is why we're here today. So these changes aim to create and expand enforcement options for tenants, create a landlord duty to attempt to re-rent the property when a tenant has to move out mid-lease, and finally update and clarify rules relating to habitability. So for enforcement, for several decades, there have been landlord-tenant laws in place that are supposed to help ensure tenants are treated fairly, but lack any sort of meaningful enforcement. If there's no way that tenants can make a landlord follow a rule, then there's very little incentive for landlords to comply with the law. And if there's no meaningful consequences for breaking a rule, then it's not much of a rule at all. So the proposed changes would add language that prevent the waiver of statutes in 504B that do not already have a waiver clause. Would create the right for tenants to seek actual and consequential damages or penalties for violations of existing statutes, and increase many penalties set decades ago so that they're actually preventative and commensurate with the potential harm done. Landlord duty to mitigate. Minnesota is one of the very few states that does not recognize a landlord's duty to mitigate damages when a tenant moves out mid-lease. Under the proposed statute, landlords would have to make a reasonable effort to re-rent the empty unit, but could still be entitled to damages suffered because the tenant broke their lease. Finally, habitability. Habitability issues are one of the most common reasons tenants call our hotline. So these issues range from maintenance concerns like leaking faucets to more catastrophic situations like fire damage. So
just if you could wrap up.
Absolutely. So the proposed language would attempt to ensure that tenants don't blindly walk into a potentially uninhabitable situation, while also clarifying and codifying existing case law regarding a landlord's obligation to keep the rental property in reasonable repair. So these changes will help ensure that tenants are better able to utilize their rights, and we hope that you support House File 3591. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Let's see. I have Juan Luis Rivera Reyes and then Cecil Smith on deck. Please please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, and thank you, Chair Beckerfin and members of the committee. My name is Juan Luis Rivera Reyes. I'm a coalition organizer with the Alliance for Metropolitan Disability and a member of the Equity in Place Coalition. We are a coalition of BIPOC tenant organizers, housing developers, landlords, legal advocates, and folks who are working to prevent and ease homelessness. I want to thank Representative Howard for championing House File 3591. I'm speaking in support of House File 3591 because we recognize that renters in Minnesota are major contributors to the well-being of our state and our economy. More specifically, we are strongly in support of a tenant right to organize bill to safeguard a number of currently unprotected organizing activities that we feel are vital for people to be able to understand and enforce their rights to access dignified and safe housing. One core tenet of the bill is the use of common spaces and meeting facilities to organize. We recognize the deep institutional and systemic disadvantages that tenants face when trying to assert their rights as a collective. We also support the privacy tenants need to make to meet without representatives or employees of owners or management companies being present. We have seen an increase in evictions from landlords as part of a tactic of mass displacement of current residents to offer units at higher rental rates to new tenants. We have seen lack of repairs and maintenance of common spaces and more intimidation of our non-English speaking tenants in the last few years stemming from the COVID-19 pandemic. Tenants feel great urgency when facing and responding to emergencies that are impacting their units in their building and will act accordingly when offered the opportunity. We also support the right of tenants to receive organizing assistance from non-tenant advocates. We recognize for tenants to truly be able to advocate for better housing conditions and challenge power imbalances that are present, it is necessary for them to be able to access resources and support in order to do so. Our landlord, our tenant leases are immensely larger as the years go on, and today's market will require tenants to have a comprehensive understanding of our landlord-tenant laws that many just simply do not have. And this is why we are thanking you today for considering this bill, and I look forward to the passage of House File 3591. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Next up, I have Cecil Smith. And then I do have a couple people, I have somebody available for questions, but are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, so you'll be our final testifier. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Cecil Smith. I'm President and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Today I'm here to voice our overall opposition to House File 3591. Before delving into just a few of our concerns, I wish to acknowledge and thank Representative Abadjay and Chair Howard for their ongoing dialogue regarding the proposals within this omnibus bill. Under Article 2, Sections 2 through 5, the language presented would curtail Minnesota housing providers from screening applicants for publicly available information on eviction actions. We oppose this limitation as current and recent eviction actions serve as significant indicators of an individual's potential success as a resident. Additionally, these sections establish a rebuttable presumption of violation, which we believe places a considerable burden of proof despite existing requirements outlined in 504B173, mandating notification within 14 days of rejecting a rental application. Concerning the right to repair section, the proposal lacks a requirement for repair professionals to be bonded and insured. The proposal fails to provide a remedy if a resident is non-compliant with the statutory requirements. The proposal seemingly allows residents or their guests who create a need for repairs to utilize this provision. It offers no provision for like-kind replacement. Regarding the right to organize residents, while improvements have been made from the earlier standalone proposal, we remain concerned that property owners' rights to exclude are not fully balanced with residents' freedom to associate. In the retaliation provision of this proposal, we generally agree in concept, though we have concerns with the situations listed. In Article 5, it introduces numerous damages and attorney's fees, which we oppose, but we appreciate the removal of the arbitrary treble damages. Article 6 revisits the issue raised in this committee approximately 3 weeks ago regarding mandatory Section 8 requirements. We maintain our stance that Section 8 should be a voluntary federal program.
And I'll need you to wrap up.
Sure. Minnesota faces a significant housing shortage, and fostering a balanced regulatory environment is essential. We fear that further unnecessary regulatory burdens will deter vital investments to meet our future housing needs. Thank you for considering our concerns.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Since I'm not going to have this job that much longer and we're giving advice to the public, when staff tells you a time for testimony, no matter what committee you're in, the chair and the staff will really appreciate it if you actually practice and try to stay within the 2 minutes. And there have been definitely some people violating that more than others in the last week. But it's just a thing that we do so that it can be fair to everybody, so that everybody gets a fair shake at testifying. So Representative Howard, I don't have anyone else. I know you have somebody here if there are questions. I still don't see Representative Egbadje, but I know she's got an important bill in another committee. That's why she's not here. With that, Representative Niska, I think a couple of your amendments are still relevant. Would you like to move the A7 amendment?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, the A5 and the A11 are unnecessary at this point. But the A7 amendment I would move, this deals directly with the tenant screening concern that we heard from the last testifier. In particular, I think some of the provisions here go a little bit too far in terms of preventing or potentially creating litigation risk to housing providers about tenant screening. And I think it's important that we think about, first of all, the business model of a housing provider, which is they depend on the payment of rent in order to in order for their business to work, in order for their investment in creating housing or maintaining housing to pay off. And that means that they have to be able to determine, at least have some way of determining the risk of default on the payment of rent. If they don't have this tool, then they're going to have to find some other tool. Representative Finke referenced the concern about credit scores. They might have to, start looking at credit scores and having a higher threshold for credit scores. Or if we take away all tools that housing providers can use in order to assess the risk of default, then they're going to have to raise rent on everybody who does pay rent in order for their business to survive. And so I think the A7 amendment is important just to try to get be a little bit more balanced in how we deal with their ability to screen tenants in order to assess the risk that someone is either going to pay rent or not pay rent.
All right. So Representative Niska, just for the record, has moved the A7 to the DE4. Response, Representative Howard.
Chair Becker-Finn, members, I would encourage a no vote on the A7. To provide a little context, last year the legislature passed as part of their tenant package legislation that would essentially ask the courts to keep this narrow band of records non-public, as these are for cases where there hasn't been a actual judgment against the tenant. And what we've saw for years and years is that just the appearance of that judgment, a tenant could have even prevailed, could still sort of follow someone's record for nearly a decade and prevent that tenant from being able to access housing. Now, there's a separation of power with the courts, and the courts have said, that we're going to, sorry, legislature. And so this is an attempt to get at that issue, and I think it is an important one. And so I would encourage a no vote.
All right. Further discussion to the A7, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Chair Howard. I understand what you're trying to do. You're looking at evictions for non-payment of rent. But I was just reading through this. It doesn't say anything about that. This is any eviction process. It could be an eviction because the person committed a violent crime. It could be an eviction because they're doing selling drugs on the property. It could be an eviction because they are causing other issues, safety issues with other tenants. Right now, I do believe that we do need to adapt, take the NISCA amendment, because it's not just for a non-payment. It is for the safety of the other people living in that housing complex. So I think it's important that we do take this amendment. I urge members to vote yes.
Representative Howard.
Chair Becker-Finn, Lee Johnson. I just would note, again, this is specifically narrow for cases where there has not been a judgment against the tenant.
Yeah, and my understanding too, and if you can confirm, Representative Howard, is that if there was a pending criminal public case, this doesn't limit that from being information that is available to the landlord.
I believe that's my understanding. If there's somebody with nonpartisan, to confirm, but I'll trust you, Chair Becker-Finn.
Yeah. So no landlord may deny a rental application based on any of the following: a pending eviction action, any court file that is not public,
right,
has been expunged or has been destroyed. Ms. Davis is not available today. So any other discussion to the A7? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, many times, you know, you just read off that language, but if there's a pending case against a tenant for a violent crime, that is public record. So, you know, if the eviction notice says that we need to evict this person because they've been, you know, accused of a violent crime, and then we can match the court record with the fact that that person has been charged with that, and let's even, you know, if it happens on the premises and the other tenants in the building have been either victimized by that or been witnesses to it, this is, I don't see in the language here where that would be taken into consideration in this case. You're just saying that regardless of what the reasoning is for pending eviction action, you just can't take that any of that into consideration, and that is that's a little bit reckless. So I agree with the NISCA amendment that we should be removing that language until it is tightened up, and that we can protect all the people living in a building. Maybe there's a guy that's being evicted because he's stalking another tenant, and the charges have been filed, but that hasn't gone to court yet. So I feel this is really reckless and not keeping people safe.
Representative Scott, so my point in pointing that out is that the landlord could still deny it based on the criminal case. They just can't deny it based on the eviction that's based on the criminal case. Representative Howard.
Chair Beckman, that's what I was going to mention, that nothing would preclude that.
Okay. Any further discussion? Closing comments, Representative Niska, on the A7.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Howard. I think it's still not tight enough, and I think, and particularly, you know, some of the other concerns that were raised, and Mr. Smith, you know, referenced specifically the rebuttable presumption provision. I think that creates some real practical problems for engaging in tenant screening that would even cover, you know, completed eviction actions. But certainly, you know, pending eviction action does have some relevance to tenant screening. So I do think that, given you know, the position that you're putting either housing providers or the tenant screening services that they would want to use, really does kind of break the tenant screening process a little bit too much. And so I think it needs at least more work, if not you know, removal of these provisions. So I do encourage members to vote yes.
All right, Representative Niska renews his motion to move the A7 amendment to the DE4. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. Motion does not prevail. Representative Niska, are you moving the A8?
The A8, yeah.
Okay. Representative Niska moves the A8, and please tell us about the amendment.
The A8 is simply deleting Section 33 on page 28, which I think is... I understand maybe the direction this is trying to go, but it's a pretty poorly drafted or overly broad. It applies in overly broad situations, and in particular, I think the worst part of Section 33 is that it, which deals with ouster, is that it deletes the words unlawfully and in bad faith, and then creates a you know, significant heightening of damages. Obviously, you know, unlawful and in bad faith. When ouster happens unlawfully and in bad faith, that's pretty serious, something we should take very seriously. But if it's not unlawful and it's not in bad faith, then that's just like a mistake, or, you know, a technology problem or something like that. And it definitely should not be resulting in treble damages, attorney's fees, rescission of the lease, et cetera. So that provision needs a lot more thinking and a lot more work. So the A8 amendment would delete that provision from the bill.
Representative Howard.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Niska, this is one where we have had conversations with Minnesota Multi-Housing, and they've raised some of these specific issues, and I think there's ongoing discussions. I would encourage a no vote at this time, though, on the A8.
All right. Any further discussion to the A8 to the DE? Closing. you just had the floor, but.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think I sure hope that those discussions are fruitful. I think that provision should be taken out of the bill at this point until it can be fixed. So I encourage members to vote yes.
All right. Representative Niska renews his motion to move the A8 amendment to the DE4. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion does not prevail. All right. I think that that winds up all of our amendments. So we will move on to member discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Howard. We had a pretty long discussion in the Housing Committee on this bill, and my feelings still stand the same. There's a lot of problems with this bill. There's a couple good things, but a lot of problems. Unfortunately, I believe that what's going to happen is we're going to push housing providers out of the market. And it's going to have the adverse effect of what you're trying to do. I do hope that you will continue working with the stakeholders that have issues, try to resolve those issues, because there's a lot in here. I don't think it all get done in time this year because there's that many issues. I do ask members to vote no on this because this bill right now just needs too much work.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, Representative Howard, a few questions that I have. On 17.22 of the DE4, it's, you know, that section is talking about abandonment, and it says voluntary absolute relinquishment of premises. What does the word absolute mean in this case? What does that encompass?
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Representative Scott. I might phone a friend on that one from our folks that have worked on. I know that came up specifically in some of our discussions, but I'm going to defer here for the specifics.
All right. Ms. Sterling.
Thank you. So that definition is so that landlords can, that there's no it's not someone has, left on vacation for a couple of weeks or a month or two, but it is supposed to be, if there's absolute certainty that the property has been abandoned. So that was a clarifying word term.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Words are supposed to mean things, so I'm trying to, understand what all would be included in absolute relinquishment. I'm not sure that is clear in that section. Representative Howard, I looked this up on statute. This is more of a curiosity question than anything. I don't know what urban real estate, the definition of that is. I couldn't find that in the statute books. And on page 19.24, it's bold print there, urban real estate. Can you help me out with the definition of what urban real estate is?
Representative Howard or Ms. Sterling.
Thank you, Chair Finn. Representative Scott. This is an old titling for the statute. It is referencing the rest of the statute is talking more about metro city real estate. It is an antiquated term the statute is not necessarily utilized a lot anymore, but it is
one of the ones that didn't have any sort of enforceability or waiver provisions, so that's why it's in this packet.
And to clarify, the urban real estate language was in the underlying statute. It isn't new language that they're adding in here. Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, like I said, I was asking more out of curiosity because I'd never stumbled across that term, I guess, in these years here in the legislature. Let's see, my next question. On 31.5, we're adding a word there for material breach. Could you give us some examples of what a material breach would be?
I'm going to assume that's a Ms. Sterling answer.
So a material breach of the lease is supposed to be, Madam Chair and Representative Scott, is supposed to be something that by case law has been defined as something that has essentially broken the lease. Like, it's so bad that the person who has done the breaching has effectively ended the contract or nullified it by their actions.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering why that's being added here, why the previous language wasn't adequate. Any breach of the lease is grounds. I mean, people sign that lease. Any breach of the lease is grounds for removal. So I'm just curious as to why that additional word was needed.
Ms. Sterling.
Thank you. Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Scott, so material is the language that is used by the courts when they're examining these types of cases. It is in keeping with what the courts already do, but also material breach as opposed to any breach. You know, we are talking about housing, someone's home, and so ensuring that it is a material breach that is ensuring that, you know, they losing their, at risk of losing their housing. So that's why that term is also important to use.
Right. Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm gonna encourage a no vote on this bill, members. And had this section under the NISCA amendment regarding denial on pending cases, what a housing provider can screen for in trying to keep their building not only safe but free of damages or people that may be being evicted for other reasons other than non-payment of rent. And don't get me wrong, the issue of non-payment for rent is a big one. And if a landlord is going through the screening process and the eviction paperwork that's been filed says that those people, the tenants, are way, way, way behind on their rent. That is a huge red flag. And what I've seen in my own experience is people will, they're going to take advantage of this. And they're going to use it to the disadvantage of housing providers. And then housing providers are going to be stuck holding the bag on this because they're going to have to take people that aren't capable of paying their rent or have a history of not paying their rent. And then the same thing is going to happen again. And so to not be able to use something that's a matter of public record in looking at whether a person should be, accepted into their building is just, it's tying the hands of the housing provider. And had that section been taken out, like I said, maybe this would have been a little bit more palatable, but that is a huge problem. And I encourage a no vote on the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Closing comments, Representative Howard.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Just to the last point, Representative Scott, I just want to clarify again, we're talking about cases where the tenant has not been found. It's not a full way through the process. And the way I think about it is, in this country, you're innocent until proven guilty. But for the purpose of evictions right now, folks are guilty even if you're proven innocent. And so that's what this provision is trying to get at. Thank you for the discussion. giving me a little grace presenting Representative Igbaje's bill. You know, we passed legislation last year that has helped improve landlord-tenant law, and housing providers haven't, you know, fleed the state. I think those laws are working well, and these further clarifications will help us take another step. And I want to note again my gratitude to the stakeholders that have been working on this bill, and look forward to that continuing as we move through the process. Thank you.
All right. I will renew my motion to adopt the DE4 as amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. That wraps up our agenda for today. Oh, sorry. Yep. So we've passed the DE4, so now we got to send it to the GR. Sorry about that. Yeah, staff is important. So I will renew my motion to recommend that House File 3591 as amended be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right. Thank you, Representative Howard. Good job. We do have a meeting tomorrow. I do want to let folks know we are not going to meet next Tuesday ahead of the break, and sort of a recognition of all the extra hours that staff have put in, wanting to give them a little bit of their time back, because we certainly appreciate them. So with that, we'll see you tomorrow, and we are adjourned.